Hey everyone, this is Josh from Solopreneur Grind, and I am here with Steve Sims, international best-selling author of Blue Fishing, The Art of Making Things Happen. Steve, really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Awesome, Steve. Pumped to dive into the book and all the cool things that you've got on your resume, but just for those who may not know who you are, who is Steve Sims? Can you tell us a little bit about who you are, what you're doing right now, and then we'll dive into the backstory and how you got to where you are now.
Wow, big question. Well, Forbes called me the real life Wizard of Oz, but a friend of mine actually, I think, summed it up best for me. He said, I'm the Make-A-Wish for people with big checkbooks. So I'm the guy that closes down museums for dinner parties. I've done it in Florence, Italy, all over the place. Send people down to the Titanic, put them on stage with their favorite rock band, get them a drum lesson from Guns N' Roses, guitar lesson from ZZ Top, worked Elton John's Oscar party for many, many years. Bottom line of it is, if you can think it, dream it, but more importantly, afford it, I'm the guy you come to.
Right. And it was so interesting when I was reading that more about you. I mean, we touched base a few weeks ago, so I've had plenty of time to check out your content and your website. And I'm looking at those events that you, you know, put together for people. And my thought was, what is that occupation? Like, do you have a name for that occupation? Or is it an occupation? You know what I mean? I was trying to conceptualize it.
My wife actually says, I don't have a job, I have an excuse. And it's an excuse to basically be able to stick your nose in someone else's sandpit and life and bank balance and hobbies and you know, lifestyle. And it's an excuse. And that's what it's been coined. In fact, the funny thing is, and we're not here to promote my company, but I got called a concierge by accident. There was a reporter that did a report one day and they went, oh, you're the concierge to the richest people in the world. That was the first time we'd ever been called a concierge. I still think it's not right. Because if you call me to pick up your laundry or walk your dog, you ain't going to get a nice response. But it's just funny that some people go, oh yeah, you're a concierge. And hey, look, if you're paying my bills, then you can call me what you like. But that's the nearest it's got. But I've been called fixer, dreamer. Someone called me the nicer version of Ray Donovan. There's all these different names. But as long as the bills get paid, you can call me whatever you like.
For sure. And I'm really interested to learn how you got to that point. Can we talk a little bit about what it was like growing up? And did you have that type of itch or desire in the back of you at a young age? What was it like? I know you grew up overseas. Well, overseas from where I am, I'm in Canada right now. Right. What was like teenage Steve like?
I think like every entrepreneur, it doesn't matter what country, nationality, culture, time frame, whatever. We all share the same bloodline, the same trait when we're entrepreneurs that we know we don't fit. We know something's not right. And you know, I'm living here now in Los Angeles. I was born and raised in East London, and I was born to at the time, very financially poor, and I'll go into that in a second, financially poor construction family. You know, my dad was a bricklayer. My mum even worked on a building site when necessary. And of course, when I left school at 15, there was no thought of college. It was straight on the building site. And as an entrepreneur, we itch. We know it's not right. We don't know what's not right, but we know it's not right. And we kind of like bustle around on our chair and we want to be engaged and we want to be challenged. And of course, when you're young, they think you've just got ADD or they think you're a troubled youth or, you know, it's all these kind of taglines you get put on. But people say, oh, you know, you're not normal. No, we're not normal. We're entrepreneurs and we want to be challenged. We want to be focused. We can only find our calm when challenged with sometimes chaos. And so I was like every youngster, but sadly being in London, it meant I bounced off the walls. You know, I got into trouble. I didn't know what, you know, I hung out with the wrong people. You know, am I looking for more loyalty? So I'll hang out with these gangs. Am I looking for, you know, these, I didn't know. So like every youth and every entrepreneur, we bounce off the walls till we bounce no more. We need to find what makes us tick. I actually talked my way. I still think it's better fiction than any Harry Potter movie. I talked my way into a job as a stockbroker, bearing in mind, I'm a 245-pound lad of ugly. I'm a construction boy. For anyone that can't see this this interview, I'm not exactly Brad Pitt or Hugh Grant. I convinced this bank that I was very knowledgeable in the world of finance, and they were actually moving, I think it was like about 160 interns over to Hong Kong to develop the Chinese and the Asian tiger markets. I got swept into that crowd. I ended up landing a job in Hong Kong, landed on the Saturday, got drunk with them on the Saturday night, Sunday night, went to work on the Monday, and I was fired on the Tuesday.
And how old were you at the time?
Oh, 20, I don't know, 21, maybe 20.
Right.
But I realized that where I was, again, typical mindset of an entrepreneur, where I was wasn't working. Mm-hmm. So why don't I find somewhere else? And in my head, what's the furthest way from being a bricklayer in London, being a stockbroker in Hong Kong, you know? So right. I took a shot and I failed. But now I'm in Hong Kong. I never had anyone around me. I never had anyone that I had to answer to or fall into the wrong crowd. I now had my own drum to beat. And that was it. It was a very refreshing time. You know, challenging, but refreshing. But one thing I did notice, and this is where I go back to my comment about financially poor, I always grew up thinking I was a poor lad from London. It wasn't until I was in my 20s and on my own that I realized the strength of my family had empowered me to. I wasn't frightened of getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to clean a building, you know, to earn money, because my family knew how to work and they taught me that ethic. And mm-hmm. So I suddenly realized that while we had been financially poor, I had grown up morally rich. And I was very thankful that I'd been given that education from a young age. And thankfully realized it in my mid-20s.
Right. That work ethic in and of itself is so valuable, especially when combined with that entrepreneurial motivation and want to do something more. Steve, before we move on, because I want to hear about what happens next, but I think there's something to say about the fact that you convinced these guys to hire you as a stockbroker, and I'm assuming you didn't have much finance experience. Correct me if I'm wrong, but how were you able to do that?
So I'm on a train. What are we in? 2 minutes into the podcast and you're killing all my credibility already?
No, I'm trying to add to it because it sounds like a great sales job that you did.
Oh, it was the best. You know, I've worked with Elon Musk, the Pope, Richard Branson, Elton John, but I still say this was my best sales job getting right. that. So as a big lad, when I was at school, I don't like bullies. I still don't like bullies. And whether or not they be on social or whatever, I hate bullies. And there was this lad, I didn't even know who he was, but he was getting picked on at school. And apparently, I don't even remember it, but I stepped in to save him a thumping. And they were picking on him. And this was in school. So I'm like 14 years old. I can't remember this. I was on a train going to a building site once, and there was a guy opposite me wearing a sharp suit, reading a Financial Times paper, wearing a Rolex. And he was like 19, 20 years old. And I was looking at him with just, I was proud of him. I didn't know him. Proud of him and envious, not jealous, but so kind of, oh my God, I wish I, it's so much admiration I had in my eyys that this guy had made it. You know, there's a chance for me because we're about the same age. Mm-hmm. And as I'm staring at him, he walks over to me. He's like, hey, Steve, how you doing? I'm like, hello. I didn't recognize the guy. Of course, 5 years had gone by, or maybe four, and he was a stockbroker in London and killing it and making money. And this is in the 80s. And then he tells me this story about me looking after him, and I had no recollection of this. And he said, you know, are you happy doing what you're doing? I'm a bricklayer just about to walk out into London's weather, and it's not exactly LA. You know, I'm about to get rained on all day.
Right.
And I said, of course I'm not happy with what I'm doing. And he went, you know how to talk to people. You know, you're street smart. Let me see if I can get you a job as an intern. And he was the guy that vouched for me at the bank to go into an intern's meeting. And one thing, an Irish lad from East London, we're always born with the gift of the gab. We know we can talk the arse off a donkey. And that was my skill set. I managed to just avoid the question by asking questions and really just skirt around it. And they would go, well, do you have experience in this? Well, is that really necessary? You know, when we're looking at this, should we be focusing on that, or should we be focusing? And they're like, yeah, good point. I didn't know what he was talking about. I just deflected like a major politician. And as I say, they were recruiting so heavy. I remember the plane that I went over to Hong Kong on, the entire plane was taken over by these banking interns. Mm-hmm. So, and they had a few of those flying over. So I reckon I just kind of skipped through. And I remember contacting him later and going, look, I do it. But he said, hey, it's nothing to do with me. I just introduced you. He said, you know, it hasn't affected me at all, you know, but you're now in Hong Kong. And he felt sorry for me. You're now in Hong Kong with no job. And I went, I'll be fine. You've given me a chance. You've enabled me to break out of the farm. And so I looked at it as a good thing. But I do remember on the Monday, we had orientation. And we had to fill in test papers and things, of course, which I knew I was going to fail, but I tried my best.
Right.
And on the Tuesday morning, I got brought into the bank. Everyone turned up at like 9 o'clock. I turned up at like 8:45. And as we were all signing in, the girl behind the counter said, oh, yes, could you go into the meeting room B or whatever it was? Mm-hmm. The gentleman would just like to see you to sign some more papers. And I walked in there. Again, paint the picture. Big, ugly guy. I've always been bored, bald. I've always been tattooed, got earrings, piercings. I'm the kind of guy you see walking down the street late at night and you cross the street. Okay. Right. You know, it's just my look. Let's be blunt. I walked into this room and there's two guys in there, both around about 5'6", small, older banker guys. And they're both looking at this guy that, you know, is a meathead. And they went, we're just going through the documentation, Stephen. We can't see your Series 7. And I thought, there's never any point in lying in life. You know, when asked a direct question, don't lie. And I just turned around and went, yeah, I don't have that. And they went, you probably have the American version, the 11. I went, nah, I don't have that either. And they both looked at me and then looked at each other. And you could see them kind of like raising the eye, trying to work out, all right, which one of us is going to tell him he's fired after like 24 hours? Right. And funny enough, we all started laughing. It was just so, and the guy looked at me and he went, how did you think this was going to work? And because we were all just literally laughing, it's the funniest moment. And I said, I had no idea, but I knew if I didn't take a chance, I would have failed. I have failed, but I took a chance. And so they said, well, you can't come back here. You know, we've let you go. And he said, but here's something that you may have won on. Because we legally brought you over here, you've got the shared apartment for 3 months and we have to give you a month's salary up front. So day one, I got a month's salary. I ended up getting like about 10 grand. And, you know, those days I thought, I am rich. You know, what should I buy? A yacht, you know, an apartment? Yeah. To me, you know, I was making like £800, you know, about $1,200 a week. And I'd gone banking. And in one day, I walked out with them signing a check for me for 10 grand. I had to go and open up a bank account to be able to cash the check. What I hadn't realized was that Hong Kong was one of the most expensive cities in the planet at the time. That lasted me very little. Everyone that I was sharing the apartment with were stockbrokers. They hated me because they looked at me like a fraud. You know, I tried to explain to them that I gave a shot, boys. You know, I tried something. They didn't want to know. And so what I would do was I would stay out all night until they went to work, and then I'd go back to the apartment and sleep during the day. So to do that, the only job that fits into that schedule was what God built me for. I became a doorman of a nightclub.
Oh, wow. So yeah. I was going to say, is that the next step? Because it's funny how things work out that way, right? Something as I don't want to say odd, but as unrelated as stepping up for someone in a high school playground then comes back to help you on this train in your early 20s, which brings you to Hong Kong. And what's the next step here? I mean, this is quite the ride so far.
Yeah, it is. And I often get a question. I hope you know you're not going to ask it. If you are, then here's the answer. But I get a lot of people say to me, "So, Steve, if you could go back to your earlier self, what would you tell them?" And the fact is, I would just tell them to stay off of the cheap whiskey. You know, there's no way that I would give them any other advice, because everything that I did wrong and everything that I did right put me where I am today, living in Los Angeles at the top of the hill, speaking with you. You know, why would I, what, if you move, let's say for argument's sake, I didn't go to school that day and I didn't defend that kid. Okay. That could have been that could have been the domino effect that destroyed me ever hitting Hong Kong.
Right.
Yeah. So it's amazing. The things that you think are minuscule and insignificant, maybe are the things that make you who you are. So don't mess with it, you know, just take them. But
right. And even those failures too, right? Because if it wasn't for the hard upbringing, the hard hours, all of that stuff too has made you into exactly the same person that you are today, and that you were at the time to make you do the things that you did at that time. So,
oh, hell yeah. The greatest growths come from the greatest failings.
And for sure.
You don't learn any. Here's the dumb thing that people don't realize. You learn nothing from success. You learn everything when it goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So why not see those failings as an incredible amount of education? And I had that perspective. If I was boxing with someone and I got a punch in my head, all right, that taught me to keep my right guard up. You know, if I'm trying to talk to someone and I lose a deal, then it taught me that I didn't handle the communication accurately. So these are great education. I've come out of meetings where I've not got the deal. And I've gone, damn, yes. How many times have I done that? Yeah, okay. Now I know. And the next time you go in, you avoid that question, you avoid that positioning, and bang, you walk out with a deal and you go, yeah. And so when I was on the door, I suddenly thought to myself, okay, I'm here now. You know, I can either cry, whinge, fall over, you know, complain that I'm poor, or I can do something about it. And again, do you remember I said to you before that entrepreneurs love that challenge, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
I was knee deep in chaos. I think someone said to me, and it's probably Joe Polish, a friend of mine or someone like that, said that entrepreneurs don't get going when the going gets rough. They get going. You know, it's a simple fact that we are in that moment. And an entrepreneur's life is a helter-skelter that would be, you know, illegal. You know, anyone that's an entrepreneur, if you mapped out that career path, let's be honest, you'd have to be insane to do it, but that's what we do. And I was on the door, and I've always been very primitive, and I'm still very primitive. And I remember sitting at the door going, okay, you are the combination of the five people you know. Well, the four friends of mine are whiskey drinking bikers from East London, and we're all poor. So why don't I replace them with billionaires, and then by default, I become a millionaire. You know, just by the averages.
By association, yeah.
Yeah. So I started making friends with the people that came in. And I've always believed any relationship you have, there has to be value in it. There has to be assets in it. Mm-hmm. And I do that now. You know, I look at every relationship I have and I go, okay, what's in it for me and what's in it for you? And people may be listening to this going, well, that's very cold. Relationships aren't like that. You're wrong. If you're not bringing any value to a relationship, then you're a customer. And so whenever I get into a relationship, I go, well, okay, what do you bring? Now, I've got clients that are billionaires. Okay. I've got friends that are billionaires. I got friends that are very, very poor. And every time I go out with these people, I know full well that I'm paying for the bar tab and more than likely the meal, because I'm eating at a restaurant I want to eat at and not the poo hole that they can afford to eat at. But these guys make me laugh. They keep me grounded. They're honest. They're true friends. The value that they give me as people in my circle, me paying the bar tab is completely irrelevant. And then I've got billionaires that if I've got a problem, I had a problem this morning with a contract. I was able to phone a gentleman who is incredibly successful, funny enough, in Toronto. You're in Canada.
Oh, wow.
And I spoke to him this morning. And I said, shit's hit the fan. I got a problem with that. And he went, all right, pour your coffee. Call me back on Skype. Let's run through it. And I was able to run through it. I said, thank you so much. I'll look after you in the future. So those are what relationships are about. So standing on the door if I was to get rich people to talk to me, I had to bring value to the party. I had to bring something to the conversation. So as a doorman, I knew whether or not the nightclub behind me was even busy that night. So if they were turning up, the first thing that I did, which turned out to, I think, be one of my magical source moments, I started turning people away from an empty club. Now, the manager came out and screamed at me, but if the regulars turned up and they were about to go in there, if they had gone in there and it was dull, they would have gone somewhere else, been excited, and gone back there another night. By me sending these people away or blocking them from coming in, I would go, look, it's quiet tonight. The reason it's quiet is because there's a new club just opened up around the corner. Speak to Colin on the door. Tell him Sim sent you. He'll let you in. And they'd be like, oh, thank you. And then they would go there. Do you know the funny thing? And it was like the Miracle on 34th Street, that little part in the movie there from Cole's department store. They would then come back to you the following day and go, is it good tonight? And right. You may go, no, it's not. Actually, you've got to go down there and speak to Roger. But you started becoming the oracle. The moment you said tonight's the night, they stepped in with full force. So you now became and I started off by knowing where the best parties were, where the best clubs were, then the best parties. Then it became premieres and jewelry launches and car launches and art galleries and penthouses and real estate openings. And then I started planning the events for these people because I had an ability to get the right people in the right room. And, you know, if you're going to sell a party, access to a party, and it's going to be $20 per person to get in, then what demographic do you have in that room? If I sell a party and it's $1,000 to get in and I only have 100 people in that room, who's got the greatest spending power, the $20 entry fee or the $1,000 entry fee?
Right.
So I started working those kind of, again, primitive ideas. And one of my big ahas was I was starting to get top slicing off of the door and off of the bar by getting people into clubs. And then I started throwing my own parties. And then I remember this. I went to a penthouse that was up for sale through one of the big real estate companies like Sotheby's or Christie's or something like that. And I said, I want to use your venue to host a party for 200 of the wealthiest people on this island. This is Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, oh, yeah, yeah. I said, any single one of these people can buy this apartment with their credit card and probably not even notice. And they were like, yeah, 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 we want them. So then what you do is you advertise the party to those people and only to those people, and it's $1,000 to get in. All your drink and all that's included, but this is the hottest party in Hong Kong, and they would pay me. Now, I haven't paid for the venue. I would then go to the drinks and go, hey, how would you like your alcohol in the hottest party consumed by some of the wealthy? Then I didn't have to pay for the alcohol. And this was my big aha moment. Then I went to a jewelry firm, and I did this with jewelry. I did it with auto, and I did it with aircraft. I went to them, and I said, okay, you market, and you spend a lot of money on marketing and advertising, because this was the time period where it was all magazines and stuff. I said, how would you like target-focused marketing? How would you like to be in a room of 200 of the richest people that have paid to be there?
Mm-hmm.
And they would go, we'd love to. Great. That'd be 30 grand, and you can partner with me on the party. So now I'm throwing a party brought to you by so-and-so jewelry or so-and-so Italian sports car. You know, I would suddenly make them a title sponsor. So without knowing it, I was now marketing, I was branding, and I was sponsoring these parties all by myself and getting paid three ways.
Right. That's incredible, Steve. And there's so much good stuff in there I want to dig into, but can we go back more to the beginning of that when you're just working the doors and kind of figuring all this stuff out? What would you say to people who maybe they're just not so good at that type of stuff? And by stuff, I mean relationship building, figuring out how to provide value to people, because you clearly pretty quickly realize that, you know, by telling them whether it's good or not or telling them where they should be going, that's obviously a really good piece of value. And that combined with how you were able to line up that finance job, I mean, you obviously were pretty skilled in that. But for those who aren't as inclined to have those abilities, what would you recommend, especially maybe to the younger crowd as well?
When you say, what would I recommend? Are you saying, what would I recommend to develop those skills?
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's an easy one. Don't. I believe that you need to find a who, not a how. If I tell you how to focus on your weaknesses and really pay attention to them, as Dan Sullivan says, you'll end up with some amazingly strong weaknesses. Right. So if your weakness is you're not very good in communicating with people, but your strength is in putting together the logistics of an amazing event, then get someone else to be the front man. You see, there's some phenomenal entrepreneurs out there. There's some even better intrapreneurs. And these are people that support the front people. Yeah, there's people with the right vision and the voice, and then there's people with the logistics and the actual control and the development and the design and the actual productivity. It's like driving a Ferrari, but someone left the engine out. You know, you need all elements. So if I'm weak, which I am in a ton of things, I find the who. And now, like financing, shit at financing. I am terrible at financing. Excel spreadsheets, I'm 53 years old. I could do, the only thing I can do on an Excel spreadsheet is open it up on my computer and close it down. After that, I can't run formulas. I can't do anything, but I have people that can. And so I don't need to. I just speak to them. They develop it. They do the projections. They do the forecasts. They send it to my logistics team, my events people. So I find the who. So if you're listening to this and going, well, I don't know how to do sponsorship, but I really do know how to do an event. Fine. Find the who that is really successful that will partner with you on the sponsorship. The downside with entrepreneurs is we have ugly baby syndrome. We believe we are the only one that can look after it, and we hold it tightly against our chest until quite simply we suffocate it. Mm-hmm. So the first and smartest decision I made, and again, I only made it after failing so many times, was to let go of that. I actually realized that, hey, I'm trying to control the money. I'm paying attention to the money coming in and invoicing and chasing and making sure that the decorations are good and the guest list is. So, there were too many moving balls.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was I looked at the anatomy of everything that I did. And I looked and I ticked. I literally broke down an entire event from the marketing to the communication, to the doorman, to the catering, to the whole event. I remember this one day, I wrote down the anatomy of what makes a good event. And the first thing I did was I ticked the bits that I liked doing. Okay. And then I would put maybe a circle next to the bits that I did, and then an X against the pieces that I hated. And you usually find that those ticks are like 30% of the entire anatomy. And so then my first job was to outsource everything that I did, but didn't do brilliantly, or that I hated doing, and I could get someone to do that was better than me.
Right.
And without a doubt, the first thing that hit me was my payroll. And I always pay per project, so it wasn't a regular thing. But I suddenly realized at the end of that month, I was going to have a, you know, make it up, a $5,000 bill. And I'm thinking, shit, I've never had a $5,000 bill. But you know what happens when 80 or 70% of your day is now removed by people that can do it quicker and faster? You now have 2/3 of a day to make 10 times more money.
Right.
Within that first month, when I got the end of the month and I got all my bills that I had to pay for the people that were involved in the projects, and it's like servicing your car. I don't know what car you drive, but I'm sure as shit, you know, we could work it out between us and YouTube how to service your car. But if you take it to a garage, because they're experienced in it, they're going to charge you, but they're going to do it in like a tenth of the time that you are, and they're going to be liable and credible for doing it. So if there's any problem, you've got someone that you can go back to and go, hey, you fix this, and it leaks again. Oh, well, there must have been a problem with a screw or something like that, or a gasket or something, but they are now liable. So you've got someone that knows what they're doing, and you've got someone you can yell at when it goes wrong.
Right.
And I found at the end of that first month, I did get that $5,000 bill, but I'd made $20,000 more than ever before. And I was like, damn, if I can outsource for $100,000, that means I've given myself the ability to make $1,000,000.
Right.
And so I always now find the who over the how. So if you're out there and you're weak at certain elements, find someone that can. And through Facebook, through communities, through LinkedIn, through local entrepreneur clubs, through YPO, through EO, there's so many different clubs and groups that you can join now that you can find people that can do XYZ while you focus on ABC.
For sure. It's so important. I just hired my first part-time VA in January because the bookkeeping and some of the, you know, document drafting was just, it just wasn't me. And like you said, it felt very weird at the beginning, kind of passing that on and, you know, giving up like a part of something that you own and built, but it's such a wise decision in the long run. Steve, can you give us an idea of what this timeline was like? Cause you started soon after the financial gig came to an end, you started at the front door. Just to give us an idea of how long it took you to kind of build up these relationships with these people and then, you know, upgrade to running events and different things like that. Was it short? Was it a long time period? I'm just trying to get a sense.
So it was the early 90s that I was on the door. By 97, I was running major events in Monaco, Stade, London, Macau. So there was about a 3-year window that I went from filling up the club behind me to taking over penthouses to getting you into amazing other people's amazing parties to getting other events. One of the things that was good for me was I knew my target market could afford me. I also know that, you know, affluent people talk to other affluent people. So if I've got someone that earns 10 grand a year that introduces me to their mate, if I've got someone that can introduce me to their mate, I know they only earn 10 grand a year. But if I know someone's earning $1 million a year, you can pretty much assume that they're very affluent and they can afford me.
Right.
But the affluent community that I dealt with also traveled. You know, if you go to the Hamptons in summer, you can be pretty sure that those are the same people or some of them that you're going to meet at the Cannes Film Festival, or you're going to meet at Elton John's Oscar party, or you're going to meet at the New York Fashion Week, or you're going to meet at Switzerland's Stade polo event with Cartier. So they move around. And the good thing about this movement is that they talk. They're in a cocktail party and they're going, oh, what did you do? I was at this penthouse, or I was on this yacht party in Macau, this guy called Steve Sims, or I was at this Ferrari party in Monaco with Steve Sims, or I did this with Elton John because Steve Sims did it. You know, before you start knowing it, I can always tell when there's a party because the following day I start getting emails or texts from introductions. So that's how it grew. And I would openly go, all right, yeah, I think I can do that. Send me 20 grand. And I would, that's how I did it. I would always ask for a lump sum of money for two reasons. One, if they don't pay, they don't pay attention. I'm not Amazon, so you don't call me and then go shopping. You pay me to commit. And that's what would happen. If you were committed enough to put down 20 grand towards your dream, I was committed enough to make it happen. Now, in the early stages, it was a cocktail of passion, ignorance, stupidity, the ignorance that I could never fail. But then the funny thing is, the more I achieved, the more doors I was able to open. And so then you can go along to someone and go, hey, we're just about to engage in a conversation between me and you, and I'm going to tell you straight away that within the first few minutes you're going to think this is crazy, but I've just, you know, closed down the Academia in Florence, set up a table of six at the feet of Michelangelo's David. And I had Andrea Bocelli come in and serenade my clients while they were eating their pasta. And that was 2 weeks before I got a couple married in the Vatican by the Pope. And then I had to come back to help Elton John with his Oscar party. Now, right. I would like to add my next thing with you as the next fantastical story that we achieved together. Can I continue? So you're throwing that credibility into the pot quickly to get them to go, wow, if he does this with these people, what does he want from us? And so it became easier over the years. I'm not going to deny that. But in the early stages, I learned something very, very quick. And again, it was through failing that I learned this. If you get a no, it means you're asking the wrong question or the wrong person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what always caught me. I would ask a question, someone would go, no. And then I'd be thinking to myself, well, why did he say no? And then I thought, well, does he not have the power to say yes to me? That would be one question. And then the next question will be, well, hang on a minute. Maybe I asked him a question that he had the option. Now, that's making me liable. That's throwing the dice up there and going 50-50. He could have said yes, could have said no. So then I started changing my verbiage. I would go into it and I'd go, hey, I want you to close down on Tuesday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and provide me an elephant with green spots. You know, If I say, can you do this? There's my rolling of the dice. If I say to you, what do we need to do to make that happen? You can't say no. You have to start a conversation. Even if your conversation is, well, it's never been done before. Well, so that's just a fact. It's not a rejection. What do we need to do to make it happen? Let's start something new. Let's make history happen. When I closed down Academia for the dinner party that I did for six people, I actually said to one of the people, has this ever been done before? Now, he could have said yes. Oh, well, don't care. I've already got the place. But if he said no, then I was able to turn around and say, we're making history. And he said no. And I said, well, isn't this beautiful? We're making history together. We're doing something that's never been done before. Can you imagine the stories that is going to escalate from this 5, 10, 15, 20 years time when the people that were here are turning around and going, do you remember when we were in Italy at the feet of David and Andrea Bocelli came out? And of course, you're selling the dream, you're storytelling, you're selling the passion, and it got them all involved. It gets them hooked. But never ask a question where you don't want to be liable for the answer.
Right, right. There's so much great stuff in there. I'm already excited to re-listen to this. Steve, can you tell us a little bit about, through that period in the 90s, you're getting bigger, you're escalating these services, you know, moving up to parties and all of these awesome things. What were you being guided by? Were you reading books? Did you have mentors at this time? Did you build a close circle? I know you mentioned, you know, you have all these really close friends now. Is this where they started coming into the picture? You know, who or what were you kind of relying on? I don't want to say, maybe relying on is not the right word, but, you know, what other resources were you using to continue this growth?
Yeah, I have them now, and rely on is a very good word, because a triangle wouldn't be very strong if it lost any one of its edges.
Right.
So I'm a great believer in leaning and finding that circle to be able to be part of. In the early stages, I thought to myself, for me to be successful, I've got to know rich people. To know rich people, I've got to give them value. Before I realized it, I had built up a company doing whatever it is I do, charging very well for it. But the goal was always to get in front of people. I didn't know what I was doing. I learned everything wrong by doing it first and then realizing, shit, I'd done that wrong. And I didn't have those people. It wasn't the era of the internet. Entrepreneur was still a dirty word, you know, pre-2000. It wasn't until I got to the end of those years, like 99, that I suddenly started seeing the Tony Robbins of this world starting to appear and the Zig Ziglars. And I was like, who are these people? You know, what the bloody hell's all that about? And I started to kind of pay attention and started to read. And I'm a great believer in absorb everything and you know, rinse out quickly. So if someone's telling you something and you go, yeah, that makes no sense to me, let it go, you know? Mm-hmm. And then there'll be other things that will happen and you'll go, you know, that makes sense to me. It's like when you're driving down the road, and this has happened to every single one of us on the planet. You're driving down the road and you've just gone through a breakup, or you're having an argument with your wife, or you've got a problem with your kids. There's something that's affecting you deeply going on in your life. And a song comes on the radio with a lyric that you go, that's me, you know, that song is talking to me. I went to events. I started going to these, you know, events, and I found them in the very early stages all very kind of like woo-woo and guru-ish. And I remember going to Tony Robbins when he was all kind of like Awaken the Giant Within. And I would go in there thinking I was open-minded, but kind of not be. And I'm looking at everyone around clapping like demented sea lions and thinking, mm-hmm. what the bloody hell is this? And Tony would get on there and he's a mammoth of a man with his huge hands. And he'd be like clapping and getting everyone dancing. I'm like, I ain't into this one bit. And I realized I only needed to hear one thing in that day that would change my trajectory the following day. Only one thing. And my education's all based on quips and quotes. And I remember hearing these things. And he would go through the entire day and then say one thing. And it was like everyone had left the room. And I realized then, and it was that ugly baby syndrome I was telling you about, I need to be more open. Because the more open and receptive you are, you get more of this. And now we're in an environment through podcasts, websites, videos, YouTubes, any way we can soak this information in, we need to. And right. I didn't have the mentorship in the early ages. And then when I started getting credible, I reached out for that mentorship. Mm-hmm. And, Jay Abraham has been phenomenal to me. You know, Jeff Moore, you may not have heard of, you know, Joe Polish, Jason Gaynard, just Tucker Max, you know, Tim Ferriss. Loads of people have helped me with so many things. And I openly go back to this phenomenal circle of resources with value for them, but also trying to see what I can gain. And I'm the first one, like this morning, shit hits the fan. You got two options. You sit there and cry, or you phone someone up. Because the funny thing is, there's very few new problems in the world today. Very, right. very few new problems. And, we spoke before, you're a lawyer. You go into an argument, there's case studies of similar cases in the past that you can bring forward. Everyone thinks that problem's new. How do I get out of this? The question needs to be, who do I know has been in something like this before? Because I panicked like shit when I saw the email this morning. I did not want to wake up to it. And I'm like, oh no, that was going so well for me, blah, blah, blah. Now I knew my next step would have been, okay, where's my learning lesson in this? But before I got to that, I went, well, hang on a minute. No such thing as a new problem. Who do I know that's really good with contracts of this level? Oh, I know. And I reached out to him. And within half an hour, he said, let's get on the Skype. And it was solved. And I noticed some intricacies in the contract that we could apply that wouldn't mean that this would become a problem for me.
Right.
And I was like, wow. And I came off of that going, thank you so much. Now I'm going to look out for those problems again in the future. So I'm educated. I'm also relieved that my relationships are strong enough that this person gave me his time. And again, no such thing as a new problem.
Right. Yeah, that's some great, very actionable stuff in there too. Steve, my last question is, what's really stood out about, well, a few things have stood out about you, but especially good things, I may add. What's really impressed me about your story is your ability to just think and do big, right? Like if you look at those events that you've organized, you've only mentioned a few on the show. These are incredible and only a few examples of some of the incredible things you've organized and put together. What would you say to maybe some younger or less experienced entrepreneurs who are starting out or in the newer phases or maybe don't have that level of confidence to think so big, right? Because some of the things that you've put together, I couldn't even fathom, the idea of offering that to people. So would love to get a little bit of that insight on how you think that big and even the ideas of these opportunities, it's phenomenal.
So I never thought big. I thought ignorant.
Right.
It was always a case of, that sounds good, but how can we make it bigger? It was always, my wife has always joked that I'm a 53-year-old, 4-year-old. I'm the kid that just goes, yeah, that sounds great, but can I have it blue with wings? I would always... Like, for argument's sake, the story of, and we mentioned it a couple of times, closing down the Accademia Museum in Florence, setting up a table of six at the feet of Michelangelo's David, and then having Andrea Bocelli come in. That started off because a client asked me to get him an exclusive restaurant in Florence.
Right.
And then I thought to myself, well, I could get an exclusive. I could get an exclusive restaurant, but that doesn't sound very sexy. You know, that doesn't sound very unachievable. So how can I make it bigger? So I literally did that. I went as big as I could, knowing that if I didn't get the academia and I only got a restaurant, well, the client got what he asked for. You know, I haven't failed. So, you know, I try to go above and beyond what a client asks for. So therefore, even if I fail at getting what I want, they actually get more than what they thought they would get. So I never right. fail, because I never give a client what they want. You say dream big. It's a case of go big or go home. You know, I would either be preferred to be broke with $1 million of a problem than $10 of a problem, because quite simply, broke is broke.
Right.
You know, not right. getting any sleep is not getting any sleep. They're all the same things. So go for what you possibly can and really go for the stars. But always focus on liability. You know, mm-hmm. you know, if you're thinking I'm sitting here going, oh, you should sell your house and put it all towards an event. No. That's not what I'm saying, because that's not going big. That's not dreaming big. That's dreaming stupid. Okay. So focus right. on the liability. What's my downside here? If I didn't get the museum, I could have tried to have got a mansion or a penthouse or a Tuscan villa, you know, but at no point in any of those things were I liable for the cost of not being able to get anything I didn't want.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, you just look at the liability, but the one thing that you have that Amazon, Siri, Alexa do not have is your ability to dream. And the second you stop doing that, you will be replaced by Amazon.
Right. Yeah. That's great. That's a great note to end on too, Steve. This has been awesome. Really appreciate you taking the time. Steve Sims, the best-selling author of Blue Fishing, The Art of Making Things Happen, which sounds like it sums you up great. Steve, where else can people find you, learn more about you, or you know, just try and get in touch or any of that good stuff?
Well, I got a website, Steve D. Sims, S-I-M-S. There's only one M in Sims, and D is for dog. So stevedsims.com. I'm on Steve D. Sims on everything from Facebook, Instagram. For some reason, I think I'm Steve D. Sims 1 on Twitter. But my biggest thing is go to the website, subscribe to my email. You'll actually get a PDF of the book. It's a segment of my cheat sheet from the book. So if you head over to stevedsims.com, subscribe to my newsletter. Hey, you can subscribe and delete the first time you get an email if you want to get rid of me, but you will get this free download. And that's it's quite a cool thing.
Awesome. And we'll provide links to all those in the description. Steve, thanks again for coming on and sharing your story. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been fun. Cheers, pal.
Hey everyone, Josh here, checking in just one last time. Wanted to say thanks so much for listening to the podcast episode. I hope you got a ton of value out of it. And if you want to keep getting more of the Solopreneur Grind content, make sure to join the email list. What I do is send 3 emails a week with additional content, such as what's going on in the background of my solopreneur journey, insights I'm having on business, and updates when new podcast episodes like these come out as well. It's free. It always will be. The link to join is in the description of whatever podcast platform you're listening this to on. Really hope to have you on the list and continuing to share these awesome solopreneur journeys and insights with you as well. Have a great day and hope to see you soon.